You're listening to FilmWax Radio, hosted by Adam Shartoff.
Hello, everybody. This is Adam Sharkoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. Thank you for tuning in to episode number 351 of the podcast. Today's episode includes a conversation with the director and writer of a new film called Booger Red. You can't see it unless you're going to a festival that's featuring this movie, but you'll see it eventually. Not too long, and we'll let you know when. But right now, we're going to talk to Barent Mader, who is the director and the writer of this film, and it is also executive produced by David Gordon Green and Ben Steinbauer. And I should mention that, of course, those latter two folks have been on the show. No, Ben Steinbauer has not been on the show. How is that possible? But I did do a screening of that Barent produced, and Ben Steinbauer directed. It was called The Winnebago Man. It was a great documentary. If you haven't seen it, of course, you should see it. It's so fun to watch. But now the roles have reversed again, and Barent Mader is the director of Booger Red, and it stars a friend of the podcast, Owner Tukel. So this is a very fun episode. We recorded it from the Montclair Film Festival, and during the course of this conversation, at one point, Barent had to leave, and shortly afterwards, one of my friends, who's a programmer at the festival, sat down just to have a snack and a rest, and she got caught up in our conversation, and her name is Opal Hope Bennett. I'm quite grateful that she did. It turned out to be a lively conversation that no one could have expected. Anyway, this film is called Booger Red. We'll talk about it at length during the actual conversation, of course, but essentially it is the story of a group of people from this small town in Texas that would patronize a sex club where, you know, I mean, just a club where they could enjoy activities of a sexual variety, let's say. And at some point or other, the neighboring county had these people arrested. The district attorney decided that he was going to have these people arrested for child sexual abuse. The idea being that children were being abused in this venue. And it turns out, of course, the whole thing was a lie. It was not true. And so Barent made this film with Orner as the lead, cast as a journalist, who goes to uncover the story sometime later. And the people that are the defendants in the real story actually play themselves in this film. So it's an interesting hybrid film. So that's the deal. So again, Barent Mader is on the show. We have Owner Tukel, and we have Opal Bennett. And it's a great, great episode. So, and it's lovely to have Owner back on, of course. The Owner has been on many times over the years, although it's been a while since his last visit. So this was quite welcome. I think the last time he was on was two summers ago. I could be wrong. Maybe it was last summer. I think it was last summer when he sat in with Jason Schwartzman. Anyway, he's back on. So let's talk to these guys right now, and we'll be back after the conversation to wrap it up.
Transcripts came in. Smith County. Start digging.
I don't want to write this story up. One of the guys who was arrested, you know what his name is? Booger Red.
Researching this story, these seven people were charged with operating a sex kindergarten for children.
Little kids were taught to engage in sexual dances while under the influence of these so-called happy pills and to possibly engage in sex acts with adults.
And was there evidence of this?
No.
My mom's like, you think you're a writer, the way you drink? I said, Fitzgerald? Hemingway?
Oh. Mamma mia, I feel so serene. It's an ambush.
Welcome to America. It's incredible. Whoa. A double.
Booger Red. Filmmaker, Barent Mader. And actor for hire, Orner Tukel. You didn't have any other
role in this film.
No, just actor. Just acted in the movie. I'm just a thespian in this. I've used all my years of acting, training and the foundation of Uta Hagen, which I studied in college.
Sure.
I put it to use.
What
to
was
be
her book?
The
Life of Acting.
I don't remember. It was a white book.
Yeah, with the orange letters or red, and she was like she was gesticulating.
The actor's method, the actor's way, or something. I don't really know. Yeah. Anyway, Barry, this is your moment. So you don't take the fucking microphone.
Barron, finally have Barron Mader on, who we also have something of a history, right?
Yeah.
We've been in touch for over the years, run into each other frequently.
Definitely.
Going back to one of my first screenings I ever hosted, it was Docularius. I was doing a series of funny documentaries, but I had already been trying to screen it for a while. And, anyway.
Winnebago Man?
Yeah, Winnebago
Man.
Which he produced.
Oh, did you do a film
I think
no,
Ben
you never were on.
Did, my
Ben,
business partner.
No, Ben. I asked Ben Steinbauer to come on to come and show the film, but he's like, "Well, I'm in L.A. or wherever he was, or he was in Austin." So finally, though, when he said, "But I'm planning on coming in like eventually. I'm planning on coming in at such and such. I'll say I'll time it with that." And then we showed the short with the guy who was on Apple. The guy was on Apple Records.
Brute Force.
That's what it was. Yeah. Anyway.
Did we ever do anything with Five-Time
He was
Champion?
There, too. Hmm?
Did we do anything with Five-Time Champion, my first feature? No.
I came to... I think I just came to your screening.
Didn't you?
Oh, wait. Did I do was it 92nd Street Y Tribeca? It is. Is it 92nd Street Y Tribeca?
I'm trying to remember the other ones we've ever done. I can't remember exactly.
Was it the downtown one, though?
Yeah.
Oh, so I moderated that.
No, he's...
It's okay. No.
It's my brother.
Hold it up.
I know, but I was seeing a movie the other day. Here's the thing. I was seeing a movie that Barrett was looking at his cell phone.
It's okay.
Said,
it's I look
okay.
at my cell phone
it's
all the time.
It's my brother, he said. I was watching... what the fuck did I watch? I was watching Everybody Wants Some, and this lady beside me was checking later.
Richard Linklater, rather.
Everybody Wants
I'm sorry.
Some. And there's a lady beside me checking her cell phone. I'm like, ma'am, can you stop checking the cell phone, please?
Good for you.
Okay, so you caught me.
It's my son. And I'm just like, I don't give a shit. And then she kept doing it. I'm like, why don't you go outside in the hallway
it's my son.
And talk to your son on your cell phone? You helicopter.
All right, guilty as charged.
Yeah, okay.
It's true. It's Koyaanisqatsi. We're in this very turbulent time where we really lost a lot of social etiquette and.
All right, Booger Red. Let's talk.
It did come back to me. I did host that screening.
Yeah,
I was the moderator.
That's right. I knew there was some involvement there.
Yeah, no, I was. It was in the 92nd Street Tribeca.
Right.
Okay. And Orner Tukel has been on many times, but it's been at least a couple of years.
Yeah,
now.
This is my fourth or fifth appearance on a Film Rex Ready. It's really good to be back here, Adam. I feel like there's been a void in my whole being.
How do you get
now
by with
refilled?
How do you get by? Like, don't you certainly feel like you're what's
lots
the
of change, things have changed since then? The reason I haven't done
the
show is I've gotten much bigger, and I'm just too good for the fucking show now.
Okay, so I'll tell that to John Turturro, who just did this.
You've interviewed so many amazing people on this show. Congratulations, Adam.
Yeah, what would you possibly be? Why would you want Orner back after interviewing people like John Turturro and now Whit Stillman is going to be on the show?
It keeps me real.
I got you. I mean, I can understand why you want to have me on, but Orner Tukel again.
It's very true. All right. Well, we're here in Montclair, New Jersey, in the Audible Lounge, and we're talking about Booger Red, which you directed. Hey, how many features have you directed? I know you said you did Five-Time Champion. I always want to say Fifth Time.
Yeah.
Five-Time Champion, which was a beautiful film, about 3 years ago, right?
No, that was like 2011.
It was already 5 years?
Yeah,
Jesus
5 years. Yeah, so this is my second feature.
Okay.
Obviously made a bunch of short films and produced other things.
Yeah. Did you feel, as a resident, a longtime resident of Austin, did you feel like almost compelled to tell this story and to set the record or something like that?
Because I don't think it has anything to do really with Austin. I read the article.
In Austin? Or no, it was
Texas Monthly.
But the incident was not in Austin.
It was in East Texas.
It was in East Amarillo?
No, East Texas is Tyler, Longview. This is in the Tyler area,
okay.
About 20 miles from Tyler.
Okay.
In a little town called Mineola.
Mineola, that's right.
And Tyler also. Mm-hmm. Tyler's where the trials happened. But I read the article. It was an article in Texas Monthly written by Michael Hall, who's a really smart dude.
Dexter. That's right. He
wrote. No, it? that's the actor Michael Hall.
This, oh, I see.
This is the writer. He's okay. A musician and writer in Austin.
Okay.
And he wrote this really compelling piece that detailed the series of trials out in East Texas, where this foster mother made these allegations on behalf of her foster kids. These kids were like 4, 5, and 6 years old, and she made these really outrageous accusations that implicated their birth mother and 6 other people in this very heinous child sex crime. And the allegations were that the kids were being trained in a guy named Booger Red's trailer in striptease and sexual acts, and then taken over to a right. swingers club to perform live for swingers for money in the heart of the Bible Belt in East Texas.
Yeah. So, of course, there was a hysterical sort of response to it, and they were all arrested, and right?
Yeah, yeah. And there were arrests. And the interesting thing that we don't really go to into the film is that, you know, one county, one DA in one county looked into this case and found no evidence on which to convict anyone, and a DA in the neighboring county found no evidence, but still went ahead and prosecuted 7 people to the fullest extent.
The county where it supposedly happened, they weren't prosecuting. It was the neighboring county.
Correct, yeah, it was Smith County.
Which makes less sense, but maybe was there an election or something like that in the...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, one of the things that kind of, you know, all of these district attorneys and even the judges in Texas are elected officials.
They're elected, so yeah.
Like, I mean, in East Texas, when these rumors surface, when it gets put in the paper that there's an alleged child sex crime involving a real guy named Booger Red
mm-hmm.
and involving a real known swingers club in the area, are you going to be the judge or DA that's going to run for re-election not having put these people away, or mm-hmm. are you going to be the one that runs, you know, having put them in jail for life?
This film, there's really not, we have to really worry about spoiler territory because it's a real story. It's been in the newspapers. It's not like we have to worry about that. But do we want to talk about the very unique thing you did in terms of casting? You put Orner Tickell in your film, so there's that, who plays a character named Orner Tickell yet again.
Can I talk about this?
And
I think one of the reasons why Barrett cast me is that I have a pretty loose kind of nature. You know, I can make people feel very comfortable, I think, you know, just because I'm very down to earth. And Barrett, one of the things about casting is he cast the real defendants, the 6 people,
yeah.
seven people who went to jail for something they didn't do, and he was going to be interviewing a majority of these, of the defendants, the real life defendants. And because the subject matter is so heavy, it's not you wanted to bring light or levity to the whole thing, but you just thought it might be a way to get them to open up more if I was around them. You know?
Yeah, Orner is like a very disarming person. So
that's true.
That's something, you know, anyone he talks to, he might annoy the hell out of him, but like at least makes him feel at ease. Like no one feels uptight around Orner.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an argument to be made to bring, you know, maybe not a light tone or levity to it, but like at least a humanistic kind of empathy, I think,
mm-hmm.
that he has naturally and just embedded in his character. But then also, he's also the most curious person I know. So he's like...
That's right.
If anyone's ever talked to Orner, they know that he's going to ask a million
And the
questions.
Role is of a journalist, and it requires curiosity is, you know, pretty much... It's a key component of your character.
It's safe to say, I mean, we all talked about this a lot. It wasn't something that, you know, Fletch is, of course, a comedy, but there's an edge to that movie, Fletch, the Chevy Chase 80s, investigative
Fletch.
Journalist piece. Uh-huh. But it's a funny movie, but it's also kind of dramatic and dark.
Are you saying
that
that was...
And you're a big fan of that movie, Barrett. Yeah. So, and you were quoting it constantly. You still quote it. Will you quote it now?
No scenes with Dobermans.
Love your body, Larry.
What's that?
I love your body, Larry. God damn! I wish. I hope I looked that good.
Am I going to tell your age, Adam?
It's public knowledge. But thank you. Yeah. But I'm all a blush. But there's no Dobermans in this movie either.
No Dobermans.
Remember that scene?
Gina Davis, unfortunately.
Did you? No. Come on. Okay. I just want to get a couple of questions about casting the actual people that were involved in their true story. First of all, how did they agree to do it? They were scripted, but they were not scripted. They just they spoke as though
they had something to say or the truth to say. Like that was our whole approach to it. Is like we never, you know.
Okay.
Basically, we approached both sides of the story. We approached people in the prosecution, the DA's office, the prosecution, the prosecutors in the case, and we also approached the defendants.
But they were acting.
No,
No. I mean, they were acting
they
like...
They were in a narrative. It's a narrative film with fictional...
There are moments where they act. Like intros and outros. Like if Orner shows up at their house, he's knocking on their door, they come to the door and they're like, hi.
Right, you pretending they never met him before. He's pretending to be a character
that's actually a very small part of what they do. Then we set up documentary interviews with them, and that is not scripted at all. That was our deal with them. They were like, what do you want me to say? I'm worried about what you want me to say. I said, I don't want you to say anything other than the truth as you know it. You tell us your story. This is your opportunity to do that. We're not going to put any words in your mouth at all. Mm-hmm. We're going to feed Orner questions to ask, but you respond however you want. Mm-hmm. And that's your deal. You just tell us the truth.
Did you show him applesauce?
No.
No screenings of applesauce?
No screening. That was not... He hadn't made it yet.
But also, too, they were very eager to talk because they hadn't had a chance to tell their story. So they were very, very appreciative that Barrett was bringing that, giving them an outlet to talk, you know?
Which tells you a lot about the case, the merits of the case. It's like, you know, every defendant we approached was like, hell yeah, I'll talk to you.
They were all vindicated, so there was no legal reason they couldn't just do this, right? They were all free to talk about the case. None of them signed anything about preventing them.
No.
Yeah. What does it tell you that all the defendants went to prison for 4 years for supposedly being part of a sex ring, a swingers club where women and child pornography was happening? They were eager to tell their story. Supposedly happened. They were eager to tell their story, but the prosecutors who put them in prison. They were elusive as hell. They wouldn't talk to Barron at all.
No, of course not. No.
That was what was interesting about the movie is as we were making it, we were trying to, you know, get the prosecutors to talk. We were pursuing them, but we couldn't.
The prosecutors, are they Texas State? I mean, do they work for the state of Texas?
Smith County DA's office.
Okay, so they're beholden to prosecute. It's not like they... was like a decision that they're going to do this regardless of their feelings about the case.
Prosecutors don't have to prosecute.
But don't their bosses tell them?
The DA's office makes a decision based on evidence and then whether there's merit in a case or whether to bring it to the grand jury. And if the old saying is you can indict a ham sandwich. You can indict anything for anything.
Yeah.
All you have to have is have a grand jury say that there's merit to pursue this as a legal case, and the Wood County, the neighboring county where this all supposedly took, where the swingers club was, the DA in Wood County looked at the evidence, mm-hmm. presented it to a grand jury, and the grand jury said we can't indict anyone based on this evidence. The Smith County DA's office looked at the same evidence or lack thereof and said we're going to indict all seven people, and then the DA's office made the conscious decision to pursue that case.
Okay.
So they were hell-bent on pursuing this.
Orner, did you feel like this was an opportunity to break against your own type?
Well, the movie gets very – there's a narrative. Barrett weaves in like a narrative, kind of a dark, dramatic narrative. He gives my character kind of a motive for why he's pursuing this case so much.
And his brother's suicide.
That was a chance for me to play something more dramatic, and that was – a lot of fun
to
trust.
Were you
Barrett
put off? Were you afraid? Were you a little?
Oh, I was terrified.
Intimidated that it wouldn't work out.
Yeah,
it works. I do have to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really want to be I wasn't too sure, and I was very. But I, you know, for people listening, I mean, I have a long time connection with you, and I kind of have seen you in the one sort of type of role. So this, I was kind of not sure. But by the time this sequence occurred late in the film, we're not going to talk about that, of course, but. I was very okay.
Well, I was nervous, but I trusted Barrett. Barrett, you know, he directed. I mean, I tried to talk Barrett. I wasn't sure if I was the right character, the right actor for the movie, but Barrett assured me that I was. And then he probably had to work a lot harder than he'd have to work with an actor with a stronger skill set. But I think he got me to a place where I'm not embarrassed of the performance, but that's because of good direction. I was really nervous, but Barrett was. We talked a lot, and he was very specific about what he wanted, and helped me get there. So, but I was terrified the whole time. But I'm proud of it, you know. And it's nice to do something that's against, you know, what I normally play. When I act in my own movies, I just play an extension of my personality. Here, I am playing something a little bit, you know. I have a dark kind of disposition, and I have some demons, but it's something that I'm reluctant to kind of want to put on film, you know.
So your own, especially.
Barrett was allowed me to kind of express that kind of pain, which is nice. It was fun, mm-hmm. challenging. It was stressful, and it was cathartic too at the same time.
Yeah.
Nice job, Barrett. You're a really good director.
Well, I understand why you cast him against, because you already said that he has an empathic nature to Owner, and he's disarming on a certain level, which may have been the case. I'm wondering what those folks thought of him, but apparently it worked because they opened up. But were there reservations about?
Like 2 weeks ago at the Dallas International Film Festival, where we won a special jury award.
Well done.
Sheila Soans, one of the older women on the porch that he talks to. And
oh, right, Dallas. They could travel there.
A lot of the defendants came out. It was really great to have them there. But she was like, she called me on the phone. She said, "I got one question for you. Is he going to be there?" I was like, "You mean Orner?" And she's like, "Yeah." I was like, "He's not, unfortunately, or fortunately. Did you not want to see him?" And she was like, "No, I kind of want to see him."
Right. So that's like a little crushed.
She's a sweetheart. I got you. Because I remember that was the stage thing. We go to the door. This is the older lady. We get to her porch, and we're staging me coming to the door, opening the door to say hello.
Yeah.
And I remember that was the one, it was about four or five takes where he did that, where she would laugh because she was laughing because I was being kind of silly. And the whole kind of, even though it was a very dark subject matter, an edgy subject matter, it was a fun fucking shoot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. But I mean, that's exactly what I mean. Like, Orner put her at ease. She liked him enough that she wanted to see him again eventually. But you know, that just, it put her at ease during the interview, and she felt totally comfortable telling her story. Didn't feel didn't feel like she had pressure put upon her or anything. And that's just a big, you know, reason why we hired this dude.
It's a good Italian accent, by the way. You did, by the way.
Me?
Before. Yeah, that was nice.
Did I do that?
I got to say this, like, Barrett's like a really, he's got so many gifts as a director, because not just as a director, but as an investigative journalist himself. And the fact that there is a sense of wanting to bring, basically, it's a story about poor people, you know what I mean? Poor people who don't have the money to clear their names. And there's a real sense of you trying to give them a voice and, like, it reveal a corrupt system. And I thought it was very inspiring to see a director focus on something outside of himself. This is not a story about me. This is a story about other people. It's a story about systematic failures of being able to have a voice if you're poor.
Yeah, right. You know? And in a way, your character is the avatar for truth and for right and for pushing back. And you'd think after the West Memphis 3 and several other true crimes that have come out where people were vindicated, because that there would have been maybe more support around it. Maybe you could have gotten Eddie Vedder involved in this case, and you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, a kind of a surprising thing to me when I looked into it further is that none of the defendants were black. I mean, traditionally, sadly, we're used to this being kind of a racial.
Except that we see in these cases that poor, you know, PWT.
Yeah,
it's an economic.
So it's a socioeconomic.
Totally. No. It's totally.
Yeah, if you're a black person with a lot of money, you know, you can get off. It's
yeah.
Like anybody white.
Bill
person.
Cosby's going on 80, and he's still walking around. I mean, you know,
O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
The Juice.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Well, he's in jail.
That's well.
Yeah, but not for.
Yeah. Mm.
By the way, there's some eye candy in this too, so there's a little bit for everybody.
Well,
Maria,
my shirt off in one.
Oh, you do.
Sense.
You yes,
towel,
I
yeah,
did. I got aroused.
He's talking about Maria Karan.
Maria Karan, who is
Maria
Karan. She's a Serbian superstar.
Yeah, she is. She is.
Is she?
She is. I think she's got some TV show coming up there soon, but she was on what I understand to be basically the Seinfeld of Serbia in that arena. It was like the longest running comedic sitcom ever in that area, and she was like one of the stars of it.
Okay.
So she has a deep history there. She's also a talented model, and you know, is constantly going over and doing like Vidal Sassoon shoots and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So she's plays, super talented.
Right. Sort of another thread in the film where she plays Owner's character's sister-in-law, and then the missing brother plays into the part that we were referring to before, from the past, the history, the dark history subplot
there's only two stories going on at once, which is really, it's nice that you made this kind of thing palatable for people to watch a movie like this, and normally might not watch a film, a documentary, you know what I mean? I thought, and you weaved it really nicely together.
Thanks.
So. It's a regular love-in.
Does have a... I'm sorry, Barry.
No, go ahead.
When you put with the microphone, you gave it to me, you just kind of like just kind of did this thing with your eyes, like, God damn, he's going to keep. I'm not talking that much. But here's the thing. What I liked about this, too, is that Barron also understood, look, if we're gonna have these two stories going on, let's make it somewhat cinematic at times in order to bring the audience in. Dolly shots and nice, beautifully composed shots. And I think the visual style of the film is really terrific. It's got a noirish kind of feel to it, you know? Investigative journalists and those kind of tropes that go with it. But not being cliche, it is a really well done, really well made movie.
Thank you, Warner.
And I assume a 1 or 2 day visit by Alex Karpovsky on the set.
Yep,
playing owner's editor.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We are kind of in a genre here with this kind of investigative journalist platform. You know, to be honest, Fletch was an inspiration for the film a little bit, especially when I started talking to Warner about it with his comedic background. But obviously, we knew we couldn't make it that funny, and we pulled it back from as funny as it was. Also, we made it a little bit more serious of a film. But,
there were a lot of jokes that got cut on the cutting room floor. There's a lot of silly stuff, right? They got,
definitely.
By necessity.
You've worked with children before, by the way, Owner.
I have worked with
you. You have some scenes with kids in this movie.
Yeah. No, I love
it. And you get an early short you made, right?
Oh, a movie called The Wallet. Yeah, that's, I made this short movie called The Wallet, and that's actually what got me cast in the movie Septian by Michael Tully, which is actually a dark. You know what I love about the end of this movie is it just gets really, really strange and ethereal and bizarre when we go into this kind of like – we go into my mental the pain that my character is going through in Booger Red. You get really, really strange and ethereal with the cinema of it, and it's terrific. And I that was always something – what's interesting to me is there's the documentary justice advocate for you, the freedom fighter in you trying to make this movie and trying to exonerate people, giving them a voice.
Okay.
But at the same time, the filmmaker – and you wanted to do something cinematic as well, especially with the end of the movie.
Sure, absolutely.
People don't even fucking expound on this stuff.
No, I know. I just think you just said it all.
Do you have any screenings coming up?
Tonight at 8:30 at the Montclair Film Festival, and tomorrow at 6:30.
I'll post this. I'm going to post this in the next.
Oh, screenings coming up. We're going to be in Chicago, the Chicago Underground Film Festival, on Sunday, June 5th.
Cuff.
Yes. That is the nearest screening in the near future. So
okay, great. Well, let's talk about something that's weighing on me: the Chevy Chase career. What do you make of that? What happened?
What happened to
Chevy Chase?
Chevy Chase is that he's just a very angry person, and that he.
Okay,
just,
Lenny Bruce was angry, and Louis C.K. is angry, but they're funny. I mean, he was funny, but what happened?
I don't know.
Maybe he took a lot of spills. He fell down too many times.
Well,
he
we know physically
times,
he's had.
You know?
Yeah.
I think he grew up in a. My understanding about Chevy Chase is he grew up very, with a little bit of a silver spoon kind of situation.
Sure.
Like, he's from a wealthy family.
Yeah.
He's probably lived an entitled life. He, was a comic genius early in his
Undoubtedly.
Career.
Yeah.
And he was treated as, royalty, which, he, earned the right to be treated as such. But, I think he just became abusive of it. He felt entitled, empowered. I don't know. And then they went to his head.
Sure.
Well, I have a theory. My theory is that, he fell down a lot on Saturday Night Live. And those pain comes. No, it haunts you later. You start getting more pain as you get older. Uh-huh. And when you have pain, it makes you grumpy and it makes you angry because you're living with fucking pain. That's just my theory. This just all comes down to.
Where did his career? Did after Christmas Vacation?
Fucking brilliant movie.
Did he just not get any roles offered, or was he?
No, he worked
Madonna on set. I mean, a lot of actors can be difficult to work with.
No, so. He had a really bad reputation of being really, really. Terrible.
So why do you, Adam? What's your theory? We're just throwing shit out here. We don't know Chevy Chase.
First of all, he was an accidental comedian. He wasn't even supposed to be on Saturday Night Live as an actor. It was not. He was a writer. He was hired as a writer. So, right. But I don't know. But he was great in that first season, right? And then he quit to be in Hollywood.
He was a drummer.
And
he was the original drummer
in
Steely Dan too.
He was.
He went to college with those
piano
guys,
player.
And he was in their first band. And
was he?
All their other members became Steely Dan, and Chevy Chase was left out. Maybe he was just pissed off. He's still pissed off that he's not a rock star.
Also, too, if you have a crippling failure in your career, that will shake your confidence. That will shake the whole foundation of you as an artist. And that talk show that he had was supposedly really, really bad.
I remember seeing it.
And it was
so
short-lived,
very
and that will probably take its toll on someone.
It's like a series of bad choices. But he made at least half dozen really successful comedies early on, right? He did
Fletch,
couple with
and
Goldie Hawn.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What was that movie he did with Goldie Hawn? The first one where he's...
At the end of the movie, he comes in the rain and she's in the cabin, right? That's all I remember about that
film.
Well,
he did a couple.
There's an albino in that film.
Right, there's an albino and a dwarf.
That freaked me out when I was in the 80s and watching that movie.
And there was a dwarf.
If you had a chance, here's the thing about, I just made a movie called Catfight in December, and we had a chance to get Chevy Chase for you are in it.
What?
We had a chance to get Chevy Chase for 2 days to play the art critic, and I think another thing is, like, there's no passion there. He lives in Connecticut, so it would have been a short ride down to New York, but, you know, he wanted a lot of money to just for those 2 days, and it's like, okay, at the end of the does he need the money?
What's a lot of money? I mean, what's
I don't want to say specifically.
Come on, give me a rough idea.
I can't. I don't want to, because I don't want to divulge what it is, that because that might diminish how much we pay the other actors.
I see.
If we couldn't pay this, then how much should we pay the other actors? But
Is it six figures?
No. It wasn't like that. It was only 2 days. But here's the thing, and this is an important point about the whole method of why we do what we do. Is I was told by my casting director, she was like, well, I hear he's difficult and he might have a problem. And I wasn't worried about that. I was excited about the challenge of trying to pull something out of Chevy Chase that maybe we haven't seen in a while. But it's the money. That's the thing that gave us pause, because if he's only doing it for the money, he obviously doesn't care about the project itself. For me, casting kind of name actors in Catfight was a big part of wanting to work with name actors, but also – looking them in the eyes and seeing that they wanted to do it for the love of it, for the passion of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and you're right. And you have Alicia Silverstone,
Anne Heche, and Sandra.
By the way, the latter two of whom are.
They're the leads.
They're the ones having the cast.
It's a 4-year epic movie with three brawls over 4 years. I'm sorry, Barrett. We're talking about cast.
No. It's okay. But I feel like we have time. We have room to do.
But
to
I
talk
do think that's like the next method. Like, is like if we're gonna make continue to make moderate budget movies. What does that lead? Like Barrett, you've got you have a business in Austin that does very well. You just had a baby, five and a half months old.
Congratulations, great,
beautiful baby. Congratulations. But like,
is that your first?
It's first baby.
Congratulations. What's his name or her name?
Her name is Zara.
Zara?
Beautiful.
Well, I want her to continue on his diet.
But the thing is, like, Barrett, where does Barrett go now? It's like, okay, of course he has responsibilities to his business, has responsibilities to his wife and family, but of course the desire to make a film. You are a director and a writer and a director. I'm more of a director than a writer. You don't write as much as – you have to write all the time to be a writer like me. I'm kidding about the whole like me thing. I write – but here's the thing. It's but like, where do you go next? It's like Barrett is such an assured director, and I think that Booger Red shows that, and also 5-time champion.
Yeah.
But you have to make something and get an actor. Attached with some kind of merit, and like you making some kind of noirish film or crime film or horror film or whatever with the kind of name actor, I think it would be good for you, Barrett. You know,
thanks for the career advice, Horner.
Yeah, because my career is just fucking taking off. You know what I mean? Like,
well, you must have something else lined up already, right, Horner? You have something else lined up already?
Here's the thing. After making Catfight for like the money that we made it for, more money than I've ever had in my life, still not much, but I felt like a Rockefeller.
Did you squander
with this
it?
Budget. No, we spent it wisely, and it's going to be a good movie. But I've got.
Told me that. They saw it.
They did see it. Did they say good
Somebody's
things?
Somebody's been
about
on the show.
Did they say they liked it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Was it like, did they shrug and say, it's good?
Or
were
No, they said it with no hesitation at all. Oh. And then.
Well, that's nice. Yeah. I'm really excited about it because I think the actors, Robert Longstreet, he's so great. But he's a supportive and whatnot. But here's the thing. I got to say this. I've been meeting a lot of investors and people who want to put money into film. But even tiny amounts of money, even money for slightly more than we made Richard's Wedding for, I still want to make films for that budget if someone's willing to write a check, because it gives us a chance to experiment and keep trying to play with the form and see what we do. You know, what can you do with $50,000? Maybe shoot a film on 16mm again. Maybe shoot 3 cameras instead of 2 cameras.
Right.
What can we do? And like, I can act in a film for $50,000 instead of a movie for like with Anne Heche and Alicia Silverstone. I can't act in that kind of movie, but I can act in.
Well, it was good because you said it was. I was thinking about this, that you made it on a much larger scale than any of your previous films, and it gave you an opportunity to really focus on that.
If
you were in it as well, I think that could have been an extra level of, it would have been a just. Obviously, it would have taken away from your being able to focus
solely on.
Yeah, when
I'm in a movie directing,
I was there on the set one day.
Yeah,
I saw.
If I'm in the movie, I am definitely directing less. I'm actually just kind of. at the whim of all the people on set getting advice from everyone, like, what did that work? Because I'm in the movie. But yeah. I can also control the kind of energy of the scene itself if I'm in the fucking
right.
scene with somebody.
Makes sense.
But my point is, like, I've got a couple of people saying, I want to make a movie for this much, and I want to make a movie for this much. And it's like, and I want to make it in Paris. And it's like this Parisian kind of, like, you know, person who might fund a movie in Paris. And it's like, wow, I got a chance to make a movie in Paris. It's not much money, but someone's writing a check. What can we do with that money that wouldn't be able to do otherwise? So Catfight was great, but if anybody is willing to put a little bit of money towards something, I feel like I'm very, very lucky to have that. A lot of people would be in that, you know.
Wouldn't you want to shoot in Europe? Do they give Americans money when they're shooting in Europe too? Of course, many European countries subsidize filmmaking.
Yeah, it's a totally different
thing. Canada too, by the way, right?
No, this would be one investor just putting up the check saying, I've always wanted to do this.
I understand, but maybe there's more money to be.
Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah. With Catfight, I had a really great producer who, like, was able to dot the T's and cross the I's I hate that cliche, but I don't know what else to say. Let's get back to Barrett Mader. He's thriving right now, and I think it's great that Booger Red's finally getting a little bit of traction, because I feel like it's been criminally underrated. I feel like with a movie like Spotlight coming out and all these other movies, like the true story with Jonah Salk, who just developed penicillin, I think. Jonah Hill. That movies like that came out. Yeah. He's playing a journalist. These movies get a lot more attention because of the big stars, and I feel like Barrett's movie really does. And
it's
I feel sad.
It's up its time. It's true. It's,
well, I feel responsible for the fact that it hasn't got a lot of attention because I'm a nobody. Like, you know, I wish if I had been cast with someone whose name mattered, this movie would be doing very, very well right now. So
it's not.
I feel bad.
Are you saying
about
it's not? Are you?
Well,
give it a shot. Let's give it a chance.
I think it's a really great movie that Barrett made. And I just feel
it is a very ambitious work. And can I ask you a question, yeah. Barrett, since we're on the subject? And Owner did bring up something that's salient, which is that I've just been to, as I was saying on the way in with you guys, I've seen four films at the Montclair Film Festival now. And all four are, you know, telling true life stories. And if they're not the only ones. So there's a documentary coming out, which is called The Witness. Which is what's the name of the woman? Kitty Genovese, who was killed in Kew Gardens, right. Queens, right. in the '60s, killed on her block. And there was all this talk about how, and the New York Times is, when I say all this talk, was generated by the New York Times articles, which were all about how nobody helped her. She was screaming for her life in the middle of the night, and nobody came to her aid. Mm-hmm. So the brother, right. her brother back then, decided, because of the apathy that was. How apathetic New Yorkers are, decides he's not going to be that way, and he decides to enlist to fight in Vietnam. Subsequently, in the first week or two, gets his legs blown off. Comes back 50 years later, he decides he's going to look back into the story of his sister, who he loved. He loved his sister. Kitty was a beautiful person and lovely sister. And he found out through his own investigation, found the very few remaining living people that were around, including a friend. She said he found her still in the building. She came downstairs when she heard the screaming. Her husband didn't want her to go down because it sounded like there was somebody, you know, dangerous down there, which indeed there was. And she was lying on the floor bleeding to death, and she cradled her. And, you know, came downstairs. And then they found out that there was somebody else who also tried to help, and the police never responded. So, first of all, it was all reported wrong. There were people trying to help Kitty Genovese, but also that the brother, you know, may not have enlisted. Like, he may have ended up going, but the point is that his whole life trajectory was a result of what was misreported, and I don't know. So I guess my whole thing, it's an incredible documentary. It's coming out in the next couple of months, and I'm getting the brother and the filmmaker on, by the way. Because I grew up just blocks away. It's a story that really, even though
I do have to meet my brother for dinner right now. But I did want to about things following up on these stories. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Like there's a point to be made here at the Dallas Film Festival, which was so close to where all this happened. We had all the real defendants out.
Yeah.
And actually, the birth mother of these kids has two of the three kids that were in foster care. Who allegedly made these allegations and all these things that put these people in prison, two of the actual foster kids came to the screenings.
Wow.
And they watched the film.
Really?
Oh, and they came up to me afterwards. One of them said, I wish you had talked to me. I would have told you something. And then they came to this little gathering we had afterwards, and they sat down with one of the lawyers involved in the case, and the kids were like saying, you know, this is all bullshit, and that this was fed to us. Like, this is all
right.
This story that we tell, which basically is correcting the story, correcting this miscarriage of justice, these kids are saying basically, like, we got the story right. And so, like, Texas Monthly is going to do a follow-up piece. But we so, we hope that we're kind of
a follow up piece. Oh, really?
Yeah,
interviewing the kids,
interviewing the kids, and,
wow.
And basically these kids, you know, changing their testimony from 50, you know, 10 years ago, like hopefully can, you know, fully exonerate the people who are already out of prison, and then also the guy who's still he's been serving 10 years in prison.
Him
out of jail.
Right. There's that guy. And there wasn't one of them unable to visit his spend any time with his own child, like his
he is back in contact with his daughter Gabby, she's actually one of the kids that came.
Oh, okay. And so they can see each other now. It's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all the parents now are back in touch with everyone except for there's one daughter that is still in the foster care system, but it looks like the birth mother will be back in touch with her soon as well.
Can I ask him a quick question, too, about Pluto Red? Because I always was curious about this, because these kids were coached to actually talk about memories that didn't exist. You know, they were fake memories, sexual memories that weren't real. But they were coached by, like, this is a big part of the article that you left out of the movie, and I'm curious why, was the Texas Ranger, who was so kind of driven and hell-bent on kind of coaching the kids when they weren't with Margie Cantrell, the foster mother. And was that ever going to be part of the film? Were you going to try to actually track him down and talk to him, Baron? Or because he's not even mentioned in the movie, really, is he?
We have an actor playing this Texas Ranger. There's so many ins and outs to this story. There's so many different levels of the justice system that broke down. You have the prosecution. You have the DA who's responsible on some level, even though he wasn't actually prosecuting the case from the get-go. You have the actual prosecutor who's responsible. You have this the sheriff's department who allowed this investigation to go as far as it did. And you have this Texas Ranger who became obsessed with the case, obsessed with putting this guy Booger Red in jail and all these other people who allowed these ridiculous interview practices to take place with the children. Children interviewing children, which we show in the movie.
Yes, I saw it, yeah.
That's all real. Like this Texas Ranger allowed a 6-year-old to basically interrogate a 4-year-old about the allegations in this case, which is totally insane. And he also allowed the foster mother to be in the room and the foster mother to intervene in the interviews and to kind of coach.
Knowing that it was being shot, it was all being caught on camera. It's just very odd on many levels. Go see your brother if you need to, but thanks for glad this worked out.
I love this conversation, but
you don't seem like you didn't smile once.
He smiles. You need a straight man.
But no, let's do a couple more questions. I'm game. I didn't tell him that.
Okay, you're coming back. Don't you have to? Okay, as long as we're not, I wouldn't want to be
No.
Okay. Well, so no.
Orderly, you don't have anything.
I have plenty. Let's. I'm going to turn this on now, actually, because
it's just good.
Would you like to direct more? I mean, it's been, as you said already, 5 years. I mean, is it that you just have so many other projects? I mean, you had a kid, obviously. That can take somebody's time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, you know.
But it sounded like it was like kind of right at the tail end of making. No. You made this like a year and a half ago or something?
When we started shooting in 2013, so that was two years after my first movie. But this one just took a long time to get in the can.
Post and all that stuff.
We had like two different shoots, and there was a documentary.
Were the people impatient that were like, I'm sure they were like, when's this film coming out? When's this film coming out?
They weren't. I just explained to them like that it takes a long time to edit movies.
And then festivals, submitting them and getting them to the right festivals and all that business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they were patient, and they're all really pleased with the movie and think that we do justice to their story, which makes me really happy, because, you know, obviously with a case like this, with people who've sacrificed so much already, wrongful imprisonment.
Can they sue, or have they?
Well,
or
I mean, no, they can't. The people who are out, they can't, because It's a little bit legalese, but they signed plea bargains.
Gotcha.
So they pled guilty to a lesser
does that
charge.
All, okay.
They're not registered sex offenders. They pled guilty to a misdemeanor, or not misdemeanor, sorry, child endangerment charge.
Was that part of the reason why that one guy couldn't see his daughter until she was 18?
Yes.
Although I know that's been reversed or appealed or something. Okay.
It is, yeah.
That just seems like, why would anybody possibly agree to that unless you absolutely no other options?
Well,
I mean, think about that. Even for a bad parent, they don't want
to. Yeah, why would anyone agree to a plea bargain? And that's why.
Yeah.
That's the question we ask in the movie. And these are all, like you said, like poor white folks living in trailers,
right? In the woods. But
they had unsuccessful trials the first go around.
Mm-hmm.
There is a successful appeal. Booger Red, the title character, has a successful appeal, and his case is coming back to be retried. And all the other cases are going to be retried. And the DA's office is freaked out because he's like,
I bet.
We've just spent like $1 million on these trying these people, and now we got to do it again. Like, what if I was wrong the first go around? And it looked like increasingly like they were wrong, and he did not, you know, want to have the political fallout of having, you know, pursued these cases, spent money and time on these efforts that were, you know, where these people didn't do anything. So I think he went to them individually and offered them plea bargains. And all of the plea bargains, he offered 27 plea bargains that all stipulated that these people had to become registered sex offenders when they got out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And they all said no. They're like, I'm not going to ruin my life. I've already ruined my life. I want the justice. I want truth to come out. I did not do this. And finally he offered them a deal that was get out of jail for time served, but you have to admit to child endangerment, not a sex crime.
Even though there was absolutely no children around at all during any of these swinging.
So, I mean, that begs another question is like, you know, if these people really did this, why would anyone, any DA in their right mind, allow them to plead guilty to something that lets them out of jail? You know,
well, look at what happened to the West Memphis Three. Same thing, though. They were also, they were not found in the not guilty. They were, you know, they figured some loop, they found some loop. I forget the name of it, named after some guy, but it was a loophole. Yeah, no, they don't want to ever admit. I mean, the DA will never admit to wrongful, you know, lawsuits and all.
Persecution. So the DA kind of lucked out. He lucked out that these people, like, did not have the means to put up a vigorous defense, to hire the right attorneys.
Of course.
To go to battle against them. So they were going to get public defenders again. Some of their public defenders were horrible attorneys. A couple of them were really great.
Mm-hmm.
And they got lucky.
Yeah.
But, you know, for them to, like, find the money again to hire a decent attorney to actually, actually defend them was going to be a challenge for all of these
people. Where's Alan Dershowitz when you need him?
I know. Well, these people had really good attorneys. Thad Davidson is in the film. Jason Castle is
The film. Who's the guy who drove Orner out of
That's Bobby Mims. He wasn't actually a defense attorney, but he provided material support to the other defense
attorneys.
Yeah,
he's a terrific actor, too.
Yeah.
And you gave the I think all the people that agreed to it, these former defendants, you gave them a lot of dignity too, by the
Thank
way
you.
The way you showed them. I mean, again, it's another case where you're showing people that are from a very poor background but that actually are thoughtful. And I mean, you know, there was a very nice moment where one of them said she was ready to face jail. She wasn't going to lie about you know, she was going to tell the truth. And so it was really good moment.
Exactly. It's something that fortunately most of us don't have to think about, but
right. You know, what would you do in the
situation?
What
would you do if someone's putting you in prison for life for something that you didn't do? And that's what these people were faced with, and it's kind of horrifying.
Mm.
But that's our story.
Yeah.
Love you guys. Do you want to? I'm sorry. I told my brother I'd be at 6:30.
That's great. Good enough.
That was what? Earth?
Earth. Earth. Earth.
Oof. Oh, my brother. You met Oof. Would you go to Sarasota with us?
No, I didn't go to.
Where did you meet my oldest brother?
I don't remember, but I met him once.
He probably came up for either applesauce or summer applesauce.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where you met him.
Maybe. At Tribeca? I don't know.
Oof's really great. He's down in Delray Beach, Florida.
Oh, I have family there.
And his daughter, his older, he's got two children, so his youngest daughter is about to get married. She's about to graduate high school.
Oh, well, marriage can't be far behind.
Depending on where you live, yeah, it's not far behind. So, anyway, but he's good. Yeah, yeah. And your son's good. Your son's 12 years old.
He's turning 12 in next weekend.
And your ex-wife is thriving with her acting career.
We saw that. Yeah, she is. She's doing very well. She's going to L.A. To reprise the role she did on Broadway in this play, Disgraced. So she's going to L.A., so I think the plan is, and I have to figure out like how I'm going to do it, but the plan is to go out there to bring the kids, because, you know, he has a sister, to bring them out there in June some point, and then maybe I may try to hang out there for a little while. I don't know.
Do you follow her acting career? Or is it painful? See her when she's on, you know, screen and.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah, you guys are simpatico, right?
And she comes. We talk about, you know, like I talked to her. She's like, I was talking to her about her thing on Louis C.K. show. You know, which
who
was
she
like,
played? Did she play his
squeeze?
No way.
And there were two or three episodes. Two or three episodes she was in. Two, I think.
Oh man, that's cool.
Did you watch it? Horace and Pete. Did you see
I
it?
Haven't seen Horse okay. and Pete. My friend, I've got a friend of mine who.
And Robert was like also going crazy.
Lots of people are swearing by how great it is. I listened to his interview on Mark Maron where he talks about the whole process of getting
did?
It made.
What's
really inspiring is how passionate he is about that, you know?
Yeah.
To abandon
for a Greek,
his successful show.
For an updated Greek kind of tragedy, which is essentially what it is. I have to listen to that episode. I have not listened to it. Not only that, but it's funny because while she was doing it, I also had Tom Noonan on.
Oh, man.
Did you listen to that episode of my show?
I know. I want to, though.
It's really good. It's a really
good
episode.
Is it really? Yeah, Tom Noonan's
It's part one because he said he's doing another. He's already agreed to come back on because I had to leave after an hour because I had to go get my kid. And we were just barely scratching his past oeuvre, you know, because he wanted to talk about his films. So his own directorial work.
Oh, he's directed lots of movies, right?
Three. Well, he's a play director, too, but he's done three features, all based, I believe, on his own plays.
I want to go back and watch What Happened. I know he didn't direct What Happened. Did he direct What Happened once?
But I can get it to you.
Did he direct? Yeah. Okay, so that was my
the
first exposure to Tom. Karen Sillis was the wife.
Yeah, she's,
and that was my first
amazing?
Oh, my God, that whole movie is incredible.
It is. Yeah.
My Dinner with Andre and What Happened was movies like that are – I love movies like that because if we're getting $50,000 or so to make an experimental film in June, it's like, well, what can we do? There's a guy who might get
the Paris guy.
Yeah, not the Paris. That's a little bit more of a budget.
Okay,
but if there's like $50,000 just to make something in June, it's like, well, how can we maximize that budget? It's like, well, through dialogue and just like simple conversations and like, how do we do that where we can shoot for 6 or 7 days, pay people. Not a good wage, but at least something. Mm-hmm. And how can we like Louis C.K. was saying, just like, how can I do something that excites me? That's in the writing process excites me greatly. So writing dialogue is always so much fun.
Yeah.
And what happened was, it's just two people in an apartment having a date, and it's just they're so good, and it's so interesting. The conflict and the emotional kind of insecurities that go with that. I mean, the exploration of that to me is so fascinating. I'm so constantly insecure that that's an easy thing to pull from. It's easy to write from a place of insecurity, you know what I mean?
He's on that too. He was on that show too. And he it's like, you know, Louis C.K., he just decided to get his favorite actors.
Yeah.
And amazingly enough, I mean, I guess there was a hole in the place where, you know, the love interest, this woman, I guess that she was cast, but it seems like he cherry picked almost everybody, but maybe there was a casting person. I don't know. But
interest on Horse and Pete who might be transgender? Or who might
– Right.
That's her. Yeah. Yeah, I've heard about that that particular – oh, man, that's incredible. She's gorgeous, beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't surprise me at all. You're a strapping, handsome – people are going to think I have a man crush. Just a crush.
Mutual love affair for the ages.
And, of course, I want to reprise some role of you in a follow-up to Richard's wedding at some point. You know, I'm just afraid you're so busy these days. Like, are you – how often are you – you're knocking these things out once a week?
Well, you know, I don't know how much longer I can – well, the good thing is
wait, what do you mean,
now
how much longer this is
No. Well, I'm not going to stop it, but I'm just a little burnt out.
Uh-huh.
Like this week, I didn't even post the show, and it's the one with Whit Stillman. But I have time because the movie doesn't come out till next Friday, I believe. So I have it, and I have a segment with Rebecca Miller too.
Oh wow, really? Does she have a new? She's got a new movie coming out, right?
With Greta and Ethan Hawke.
Is it a very small personal velocity?
Julianne Moore, who.
You ever seen Personal Velocity?
You know, I was talking to her about it, and I said, I've seen all your movies except for that one. I don't think I've seen it.
I learned a lot listening to the commentary of Personal Velocity. I can't remember if she did the commentary, it was one of the actors. They talked about the construction of a scene and how every scene kind of has a middle, beginning, and end itself, mm-hmm. like a three-act structure of even a scene.
Yes.
And that, like, one of the things that Rebecca Miller did, because Personal Velocity is three stories, one with Kevin Bacon's wife. What's her name?
Kira Sedgwick.
Kira Sedgwick. The first mm-hmm. is with her. The second is with Parker Posey. And the third scene of the movie, the third story of Personal Velocity is Veruca Balk. How are you?
Good to see you. Opal Bennett.
Well, I met Opal last night. I met you last night, right? And you're you work here at the festival, and it's great. I listened to your intro to Robert Greene's movie, and it was – or what was
Wait,
it?
Wait, what was
Cry?
Robert Greene's?
Which one did you do the opening?
I did
So Don't this is cry. Opal. Who say hello?
Hello, everybody.
Oh, this is such
We're at
a
the Montclair
beautiful,
Film Festival. How long have you worked at Montclair at the film festival?
This is my second year working for the festival.
Did you know to have a relationship with Tom Hall before? Is that why you came on?
I met Tom Hall at the prior Sundance while he was still at Sarasota.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, what festival were you coming from before Montclair?
Tom gave me my first break. Oh, I was a pre-screener before then, and. My first programming job was for Mr. Tom Hall. Thank you, Tom.
Well, Opal's not only doing a great job, but she's also, it's at the end of the night, like at the hotel, like everybody was crowded around having a conversation, and it was terrific. And you were there, like right there with everyone. It was terrific and easy and to talk to and cool to talk to. And
oh, well, thank you so much. I like to be a good host.
You know who Rebecca Miller is? Do you ever see the movie Personal Velocity?
Yes, I know who she is. No, I have not seen Personal Velocity.
Why do you know her? What's your familiarity with her work?
As a very brilliant filmmaker.
Good answer. Did she direct The Crucible? With Daniel Day-Lewis, who she married?
She didn't do The Crucible, did she? She did a movie with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Who directed The Crucible with Winona Ryder and Daniel Day-Lewis? Wasn't her?
Do you know that?
I thought it was her, but I may be wrong.
You have stumped us. I did, however, just see The Ballad of Jack and Rose.
Okay, she directed that. That's right.
She did, right.
She did. Yes, yeah.
That's where her husband was in.
Yeah, okay.
Face.
You know, at the tail end of my interview with Rebecca, she's one of a couple of interviews I had in the last week or so, because there's this new movie, Maggie's Plan, which will maybe be on the same episode as this. But I said, you know, about 25 years ago, may have been longer, but I think it was around then, I was on the Upper East Side and I was crossing 68th Street and I walked past Arthur Miller.
Uh-huh, her father.
Yeah, and I kept going, and I was like, no.
You were going to maybe stop and talk to him or something?
I walked by him. I recognized him. I kept going because you have to let it sink in, and then I'm like, no. So I said, like 30 seconds, a minute later, I said, no, I got to go and talk to him. And I started running back, and he was on the median island in Park Avenue, you know how it's this right between the two lanes, and he was on there waiting for the light with somebody. But I said, Mr. Miller, I had to come back. Well, I have to shake your hand. And he tossed his head back and he laughed and he shook my hand and he said, it's nice to meet you.
Moment. That's the ultimate impulse that I have when I see somebody that I admire is like just go up and it's like, but then I don't want to end up being just like kind of the vapid person that everyone does. Because I was on a movie called Andersonville when I was in Wilmington, North Carolina, and John Frankenheimer was directing that movie.
Oh, my God.
And it's
one
like,
of the greats.
And there was probably 300 extras there. We were all playing Confederate soldiers. Wait, we were in the
really?
South, so we were Confederate soldiers.
Andersonville, oh, of course.
Andersonville, yeah, sure. Was the prison. I guess we were playing Union soldiers. No, it was Confederate soldiers because the prisoners would have been Union soldiers. So I was playing a soldier there, and I got singled out to get special lapels put on by, like, the costume assistants or whatever. And Frankenhammer happened to be standing right beside him, and he's surveying the whole landscape, and he's trying to figure out what the scene is. He's tall, and he's magnanimous, and he's amazing. And I'm like, oh, Mr. Frankenheimer, can I just shake your hand? And like, and I'm just like, nothing extra there. And he looks down at me, and he's this look of disgust on his face. This is the way I register. But he put out his hand, shook my hand, and just didn't even say anything, and then just kept doing what he was doing. But it was a great moment for me.
Sure.
But I was at Miles Ahead, the Miles Davis kind of movie that John Cheadle did recently. I went to the premiere a couple of weeks ago, and there were like amazing people there. Spike Lee was to the left of me. I talked to Spike Lee because I had just seen Chirac, and I just wanted to tell him how much I liked it because I've always been a big Spike Lee fan. He was a big influence on me in the early 90s, but I haven't loved anything he's done maybe in like 10 years, but Chirac had so many amazing, powerful, really cool scenes and stuff like that. And like, there was so much so many ambition of ideas, you know, a fearlessness.
It's very true. You know? That is true. But I have to say that.
But hold on, let me get to this point.
Oh, yeah,
here.
Of course.
Which is very quick. This is about like being sycophantic. Being sycophantic and not wanting to go up and be sick. I was sycophantic to Spike Lee, but I had just seen Chirac, so I was talking about the kind of themes about that, right? Yeah, which were really interesting. But Ian McGregor was at the screening too, and I always wanted to. I didn't want to go up and say, Ian McGregor, I love Shallow Grave, I love all this stuff and all the early work. It's really, really cool. And you played like Obi-Wan Kenobi. But the question I wanted to ask him was, I'd heard. Ewan McGregor. Yeah, I don't even have to fucking pronounce his name. And this is the point of the story, which is like, he was at the after party and I had a few drinks. So I was getting my nerve up and I'm like, I'm going to ask him this one specific question, which is, Robert Longstreet told me that he had read when Ewan McGregor. I'm such a fucking moron. When Ewan McGregor had done the Star Wars movie and was cast as Obi-Wan Kenobi, of course, huge, amazing, you know. Right? Yeah, he played Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Casting Koo. No,
the main guy, the guru. Is that Obi-Wan
Kenobi? He played a young Obi-Wan.
He played Obi-Wan, and like, he was so, of course, excited to do it. Then when he actually got to set and for whatever 6 months was on a green screen the whole time, he was so like dismayed by the whole thing that he had to take a cross-country road trip on his motorcycle or something, or across the world or in Indonesia or wherever the fuck he did it. Robert Longstreet told me this story, and to me it's like really fascinating. You get so excited about anything in your life, and then, of course, you're let down by the process. And I wanted to ask him just about that specifically. And I was at the bar, and I wasn't going to – he was talking to all his friends. I wasn't going to walk up to him, and I was waiting for the moment. And he walked up to the bar. He's, like, right beside of me. And I'm like, Mr. McGregor, and I couldn't say his fucking name. And he just looked at me and just walked away like, gee, if you're going to talk to me, get my fucking name right. And maybe that's not even – maybe he didn't even hear him.
You know? It's happened to all of us.
But it's just like, I wanted to – I felt like I had something to say besides, I like your work, I love your – I had something somewhat
interesting. Right, you had a good way in, as it were. You know, something
to engage. Yeah, I was in a bar in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Dennis Hopper used to live in Wilmington.
Oh, wait, you're not going to tell me you met Dennis Hopper.
I met Dennis Hopper, and it was like amazing. I was talking to him like a regular person at a bar, and he was loving me. He was laughing. He's like, oh, man, this is awesome. We're having conversations. And then I'll never forget this, because I learned a really big lesson about being a sycophant, is that I was like, blah, 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 this and that. This is like, and Mr. Hopper, like, he didn't know I even knew who he was until I said, and Mr. Hopper, I just love you. And his face wilted like a fucking dead flower.
Yeah.
And I immediately was like, that was wrong.
Yeah.
Move, you know?
Somebody was telling me, an actress, so, you know, who does reasonably well, she was cast in a movie with Holly Hunter, who I got to know, actually, because my kid was going to school until this year with Holly's children. Like,
oh, wow.
And so
Holly Hunter in New York?
Yeah,
oh,
she's in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
And so I would see her at the school all the time, and we got to know each other and chat every few days.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I was getting, you know, I could never bring up doing the pie. Not for a while. I had to really let this gestate, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I heard about an anecdote where a friend, I have to remember who the actress was, but a great actress, but she was such a fan, and one day they were on the set, and she just said, I'm such a fan of you. She asked her for an autograph at the end of the shoot or something like that, and she could just see, like, that shroud came over, that. But I wanted to say something about Spike Lee, who I have never wanted on the podcast. Well, maybe at the very beginning, because I know, you know, he can be very prickly and difficult, and it could go badly. I, of course, will do it if he... if it's an option.
I was going to say.
Of course,
if he was,
I'm not
like,
an idiot.
Hey, Adam, that you'd be like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm saying, can I put you in touch with Mark Maron? Yes, I'll do.
When I worked at a public TV station in UNC.
That's how you pronounce the actor's name, UNC.
UNC, right.
McGregor.
Well, finish your thought. Finish what you're going to say about, like, so.
So I was just going to say, I saw Red Hook Summer, and you know, it's a really difficult film. It's it did really badly. But I want to say that I still walked out admiring. It's an experimental film. I mean, I really walked out almost like I don't think there's anything commercial about it. Like, I still thought this is not the movie you're trying to make to gauge new audiences and to find, like, have new audiences find him and to keep. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't think he's motivated that way as when he's making those films. Like, I just think he's still making films that he wants to make.
Well, also, he's always been giving the voice to the marginalized, you know, poor Brooklynites, you know, poor people of color. But also never saying it's just the black story. It's the story of New York, which is a mixture of so many Italians and Jews and blacks.
Well, he's saying
and
like
Puerto
Woody
Ricans,
and like
you know?
Marty made, he's doing the same thing. And
yeah.
But it's his own.
I appreciate that aspect of it. You know what I mean? Just hearing stories that you don't normally get to hear. I just, oh, good God, like Jungle Fever and Clockers and the movies in the 90s. Summer
Hour.
Sam even I fucking love so much.
Me
you know?
Too.
I would go to see a Spike Lee movie like I was going to go see any movie that I was excited about in the 90s.
Didn't he do 25th Hour? And he also did, what's the one in the bank heist movie that he did?
Oh, that awesome scene in which one?
The one he's doing a sequel to? Bank Heist. Or maybe he already did the sequel.
Well, I was just going to talk about Spike as a documentarian.
Okay.
Four Little Girls.
No. Right. Absolutely. There's tons of great documentaries.
And, of course, When the Levees Broke.
Brilliant. He did one on
And you don't see
he
those.
He did a great one on Jim Brown.
He did a documentary on Jim Brown? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
It's terrific.
I mean, you'll see a lot of movies, about the Holocaust.
And
see a lot of movies about, whatever. People marginalized and oppressed, horrible stories of genocide and whatnot. You rarely hear this, it takes a black filmmaker to kind of, I'm generalizing the fuck out of all this. Cut what I just said. It's Spike Lee is like issue driven movies and like a conscience to say, look, as a filmmaker, I can reach and educate and that's it, while entertaining at the same time. You know what I mean? And I think that's. Oh, you don't agree with me at all, Opal, right?
I think that Spike is an artist first and foremost, and that he's always had a particular voice and perspective that's his own and that's not necessarily tied to any kind of obligation he feels vis-a-vis his identity. He has always just had his own unique voice and has spoken as an auteur from day one. And I think that's all he wants to do.
That's true. That makes sense. It's like it's because he's a black filmmaker doesn't mean he's making black films. And he has an obligation to do that. And I think that's great. It's interesting. I just saw Captain America: Civil War. Black Panther is amazing in that movie. By the way, it's really they're going to make a movie about Black Panther. Fact that they're getting a black director, do you feel like that it's appropriate? Like there would be an outrage if it wasn't a black director making a movie like Black Panther. I mean.
I don't think so. I think it's just inclusive, casting is not the word, inclusive production then, which needs to happen more and more with both people of color, with women. You look at the documentary side of things in film, and there's parity for the most part. You look at slates.
P-A-R-I-T-Y.
P-A-R-I-T-Y, mm-hmm. Right? You look at the Sundance slate. And see how many women directors there are. Obviously, Sundance is not putting forth films that aren't high quality, right? So what is this? You go to the Hollywood side of things, and it's less than 1%, films being helmed by women. And it's not that you can say, oh, when a woman helms a film, Frozen, or the Twilight series, that these aren't successful films.
That was just, by the way, just the woman did the first one, though. That was taken over by a man.
Catherine Hardwick
did only the first one. Okay. And then she dropped it, and then a man directed the next.
Okay.
Yeah. But just because I had Catherine Hardwick on recently.
Fair enough. But she set the
She thing. Sure did. And
But Frozen, written and directed mm-hmm. by a woman.
Mm-hmm. Many. So, great films.
There's an issue there, I think, once you get to the Hollywood side of things.
I think about the Karen Kasuma. Who is the woman who did Girl Fight? And then she ended up doing the she's
Alison Anders?
She's Asian. No, she, okay, no. Karen. Cause she just no. did. Do you know who she is? She just did a movie called The Invitation. It's okay, right? Like, is that her? Am I pronouncing her name right?
Karen Kusama, I think.
Well, I remember she did Girl Fight, which launched Michelle Rodriguez's career. I think I'm pronouncing her name right. I'm amazed if I remember any names right now. Then she ended up doing the adaptation of an MTV cartoon called... I can't remember the name of it. It starts with an A. Wanting to say Aldous Huxley, but that's not Aldous Huxley. Which
something Flux.
Flux. Eon Flux. Eon Flux.
Was it Eon Flux? It is.
With Charlize Theron. With Charlize Theron. And that movie bombed and was, I think, critically a failure. And like you haven't really heard much of her since then. And you think about in Hollywood, if a male were to have they get several chances to keep making projects. And I saw The Invitation, which I thought was really, really well directed. Like, I didn't like the script, you know, and I thought, but she didn't write the script. But as a director, sometimes maybe you should make a few, whatever, changes or whatever. But it's really beautifully done and well done and really entertaining and interesting. And like, she has to make this movie that's basically probably $1 million movie in one location after making these multi-million-dollar movies, after making Eon Flux, which has been more than a decade ago, you know? But that also brings up the idea that, because there's such a glut of minority-directed pictures directed by women, that when something comes out that's somewhat original and interesting, like I'm going to use Dear White People as an example, because there's not a ton of films like that come out, that if a film comes out that I think it's a mediocre film, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, I can appreciate what it's trying to do, but compared to, like, the impact that Spike Lee had when he was making his films, I'm like, compared to the worst Spike Lee in the 90s, I don't think Dear White People touches it. You know what I mean? But because there's not a ton of movies coming out by minorities, I feel like you have to take things that maybe aren't necessarily that good sometimes to get championed or, like, appreciated, I think, unfairly. I think that's part of what's wrong with the culture, is the sense to get on board this bandwagon of canonizing or allotting something that's good. What's his name? Simeon? What's the guy's name?
Justin Simeon.
I think he's very talented. He's an interesting filmmaker, and he's going to do interesting things.
Dear White People?
Dear White People. But the absolute majority of all the critics saying it's so amazing, I didn't see it. I want to be able to say that.
Did you see the quality when you say you didn't see it, or you didn't see the movie?
I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was that well made. I saw the ideas there that were interesting, like Chirac. It's like
I was
not just compare all the black filmmakers to other black filmmakers. You know what I mean?
Doing careful.
I know. But I don't want to be careful about it, because it's like, how can you? I'm not going to censor my loud mouth that talks. I'm not. I mean, I grew up in the South. I have racist tendencies. You know what I mean? I'm not going to pretend that I haven't said racist things, that I don't have inherent racism when I'm at my basis level. You know what I mean? When I'm angry, I can be anti-Semitic. If I'm in the right situation, I can be anti-black. I can be anti-women, because it's just a reaction to being upset or angry. It's just like, you know what I mean? It's not inherently I'm not, you know what I mean, that way.
It's in your fiber on some level. Is that what you're saying? Well, that it's in there. It's not. You have to be aware of those things.
Well, being told you can't say this or you can't do that. It's almost like, why can't I? I'm not a mean person. I'm not angry, but I'm also human. And human
there is
something mean saying things that aren't
just. But there's
just.
Also – there is another level to us as an hopefully, I think, evolved group is sensitivity and aspiration. So, yes, I guess I see pushing back against the socially correct, obnoxious stuff that goes on. I don't like that, but at the same time, I think we can make choices about how we behave and reject parts of, you know, who we are. But that doesn't. But I agree on also that, I mean, there is always some dark stuff and poison in all of us. Do you look at it as poison at the same time, or are you saying that those instincts you talked about, as you described, there is at your basis points, maybe you recognize some.
Look,
I can be
on a subway and be the only white guy on a subway, depending on where I'm going, and ever have a racist thought in my mind and think it's beautiful. But if I'm on a subway and I was at a movie theater the other day and there was a black guy in the theater being extremely obnoxious, and it was like it was that not moment of like, because there were plenty of black people that weren't being obnoxious, there were plenty, you know, but it was like for that moment I thought, there's a reason why there's some racism because of people like what you're doing. This sounds horrible, you know what I mean? But it's that base thing inside of me, that conservative, maybe southern, you know, kind of sense of like, you know what I mean, like just. Or it's like being at a gay pride parade. Like, it's like I'm completely not homophobic. I have so many gay friends. I love gay people. But at the same time, if you have a gay pride parade and sometimes it's like there's 1,000 people all dressed in insane outfits acting real – I've like been in gay bars where the whole bar was acting like they were in high school. And I have those moments of like judgment, you know. And I'll judge myself. I think I'm a horrible person. But I'm not going to pretend that that doesn't exist. Those thoughts aren't in my head. You know what I mean? And I feel like the ability to say this is, again, coming to an awareness of right. If you say that you're going to get rid of mental racism, it's impossible. If someone says – if this is very tricky terrain to – you know, the way you're looking at me right now, Opa, was like, you know, like you – like watch what you say. It's just like – there's a difference between.
Well, she may have also been looking out for you, not knowing necessarily about you.
Listen, I'm at a part
and
of
like,
my.
I think knows a little bit more about.
I'm
you,
not
like,
listen,
as far
I,
as
I,
being
I,
speaking.
I'm never
freely
going
about.
To say if someone sits around and criticizes you're an asshole, you're racist for something which it was taken out of context. I'll shrug and say, okay, fine, you save that. But I know that I'm not that way.
Right,
my friends
right.
who know me know I'm not that way.
Sure.
I'm not gonna be. Edited by this sense of censorship, this sense of like mental censorship, you know,
for
what I
the
mean?
Better for right. In other words, there's an expectation that you don't say things because less evolved people will not understand it. And there's that too. And then what does that mean? We edit ourselves because of dumbing down on a certain level or because we're trying not to offend people that don't recognize the context. I agree. I think that it's good to be able to say how you're thinking and feeling. Giving people the benefit of the doubt, I guess, is my point.
We were just talking now, right? It's not like we're having a conversation. You and I, it's not about being careful, Opal. If it's like if I'm saying something that offends you, we are right in front of each other right now. You can say, I find that offensive because, and I could listen to that and say, but no, that's the thing. This is the difference between saying something off the cuff, just kind of, you know, whatever, just running your mouth and just, you know.
But maybe
just,
she was, but do you want to?
Okay, so be careful was, this is a podcast. This is going to be publicized.
Yeah, that's
people
what I
are going to have an impression based on what you said.
So she
right?
was.
I personally, it takes a lot. You got to work hard to offend me.
You have to work hard to offend me too. You can look someone in the eyes when you're right beside them and see there's not hate in their eyes. There's not racism. They're not. They're not. It's like, and when you have a conversation one on one with someone, you know what I mean. You offended me. Why? And let me tell you why. And I can say, oh, I'm sorry, that wasn't my intention. I apologize. Because, you know, I think that's what's beautiful about the culture we're getting into is trying to be sensitive to people's personalities, to their emotions, to not oppress anyone by saying something that might make them feel dehumanize them or whatnot. So that's a good place to be. But I think you can go overboard with it. And I think I'm a hardcore liberal, but I also think this kind of PC culture is going to create more conservatism. It's not – I don't know if it's necessarily helping the cause of, you know, liberal causes when you're saying, look – because at the end of the day, I think censorship of any kind is a conservative kind of aspect. It's not a liberal thing.
Well, I mean, I think on a surface level, which is how generally conversations operate on podcasts, you know, it's – I'm going to guess, Opal, you were just
– I just – kind of sat down to have a quick break in between two meetings. I gotta go back to work.
But I
will say this as a parting thought. Look, I think our sphere of public discourse has gotten it's less than ideal right now. Let's just say. I don't think that people engage in a lot of challenging discussions where they challenge somebody's ideas. I think there's a lot of, you know, kind of debasing down to name calling or, you know, faux outrage, you know, and a lot of it is because it takes place in social media spaces and it's not really, you know, the best platform, I think, for people to really engage in a substantive manner.
If
they don't want to. I think it can be used in that way. I don't want to, you know, dismiss it out of hand. But what you often see is just the, you know, very lowest common denominator of public discourse, and it's a problem. I think people, you know, take it offline and kind of engage in the same sort of way, and so you can't have a discussion or, you know, a challenging exchange of ideas, right? It always has to debase into this. I'm just going to you know, judge you completely and dismiss you and call your name and, you know, and off I go and huff. I mean, that's ridiculous. There's no way for us to really progress into challenge each other in any sort of a
and connect,
know, intellectually
and get to know each
way.
Other. Yeah,
yeah.
The
at
war,
you're going to say, not if you're afraid to talk.
Also,
you know what I mean?
No,
yeah,
no, right? No, absolutely
but
true.
It be coming
we're
from
also
a place of trying to be insightful, right? Not that I'm saying that you were, but you know, it needs to be coming from a place of like I have ideas that I want to exchange, and I want to be able to speak freely, right? And you shouldn't be like really sent like you said that. I'm, honestly, Adam. My instinct was, whoa, this is going to be publicly broadcast. That was the be careful. It wasn't like, you know what I mean? I don't know how I feel about him. No, no, no. You get.
But that's the difference between saying, taking something out of context, listening to something and saying, he sounds like an asshole, he is an asshole, and being right beside of someone, you know what I mean? And saying, I know you're not. Like, you're judged. Yeah. Based on one thing that goes to everybody who reads it or whatnot, all of a sudden you're stigmatized.
That's
as a dick.
The operation that from which PC comes.
Right.
PC-ness comes.
PC-ness. And I wanted to mention.
I got
to
run.
Okay.
I
did want to.
I'll see you tonight. We'll have drinks tonight. It'll be great.
I want. Well, we will. I want to thank you.
What's
by
your
the
last
way.
Name?
Bennett.
Opal Bennett. Opal Hope Bennett.
Hope Bennett.
Bye.
So
what
do you do? She's a programmer.
I am a programmer.
For the
Montclair Film Festival.
I'm so glad I'm so glad. I mean, I don't know if you are, but because I also say a lot of these conversations. And the kind of discussions that go on around these issues happen in a very defensive times, like when we're having elections and everybody's up against. See you later. Everybody's like feeling threatened that we're going to get then somebody in power that represents the enemy, and so you end up having these talks about race during those times when they should happen when we're not feeling defensive at all and we're open to having, you know, it's like,
well, it's one thing to have a shocking to say something shocking or ribald just to incite, you know, people's to get attention, you know, what I mean, the way Trump does. It's another just to have a free-flowing conversation of ideas and saying, yeah, okay, maybe I say some things that people would disagree with. But, you know, it's so easy to just sit there and 145 characters label someone a dick saying, oh, you know, like I was reading somewhere where someone mentioned something about blah, blah, blah. This was a great movie directed by a fucking girl or something. And all of a sudden, millions of people, thousands of people, hundreds of people, whatever. Girl, why isn't she a woman? Why is she not a girl? Just to single that out. I don't know. Like, but I guess it depends on.
It's nuts.
Everybody wants to be heard and outrage and complaints are a big part of being human. We have to have something to complain about in this privileged country and world that we're living in. You know what I mean? We have to have something to say, look, I matter. Let me complain about something that's really, really irrelevant. I'm not saying the cause of being labeled a girl as opposed to a woman is not a legitimate, I mean, complaint, depending on what you've gone through. But it just seems overall, in a broad stroke, this sense of like, being afraid to talk or say, you know, I've got a loud mouth. If I have to like think too much about what I say, I'm just going to be, you know, I'm hamstrung in a way where I can't even.
Well, doesn't that same impulse or rather lack of filtering, isn't it that also makes you a passionate filmmaker and storyteller?
I guess it gives me a kind of voice.
Because if you start to filter, it's going to affect that too. I mean, it's going to start to creep in and shake your confidence. We're talking about Chevy Chase. But where it starts to shake your confidence.
Sure. If you don't feel
I wish I had that a little bit more. I even though I'm at the age I'm in, I'm still reinforcing that about myself. Like, get out of your own way.
Yeah,
you know, like who do you care that's judging anymore?
Yeah,
you know,
right. Well, I feel like for me, like I have an insecurity about my intelligence or how intelligent I think.
Well,
I think
in particular.
As I get older, I realize I know nothing, and I never. And when I was younger, I thought I knew something, and I know I don't. But at the same time, I don't want to sit there and ever think about whether or not I sound like an asshole. I'll never talk, or if I sound like an intelligent person, I'll never talk because I think. How do I word this in a way that makes me sound astute or like, you know, somewhat cerebral? And like, how can I put the, and that's what most politicians do. I think that's why Trump's getting such traction is he's not speaking like
he's
someone who every word
right,
is
right,
measured.
Right.
And he's like, listen, I'm going to say whatever I want to say, knowing that it's a complete opposite of being measured about what you're saying.
We need to definitely understand why he is appealing to so many you know, people. And one of the reasons is, of course, there really are a lot of morons, but, you know, that are.
Well,
I mean, this is, you know, I understand why people, what the appeal is, but, you know, then there's.
Well, we're talking about Louis C.K. I heard an interview with him the other day on YouTube while I was working my day job, and I was listening to some, you know, podcasts and whatnot, and he was talking about Trump's
lack of empathy in terms of when he talks about, you know, different, you know, races and different, you know, we should ban Muslims from coming in the country. The lack of empathy that goes with being a his particular brand of like politics. And if you don't have empathy as a political leader, you know what I mean? Like, you're dead. You're nothing.
Do you know that the new mayor of London is a Muslim?
Yeah, I heard about that.
How is it possible that any president of this country could possibly think that they could create alliance of any type with, you know, when they don't see?
I don't know how much power the mayor of London has.
No,
you know?
No, obviously not.
You know what I mean?
But it might just be like. Of course, yeah. It's a municipal.
It could be just something for they're doing just for peace PR.
Oh, that's
purposes,
true too. I wasn't even thinking, but I know. Of course, I know he's not a world leader, mm-hmm. but. The Prime Minister of England has a relationship with that mayor of their biggest city. I'm just thinking the leader of this country has to have respect for the mayor of London. You know, and why would you, if you're saying we don't trust Muslims, we don't want any more Muslims coming to this country, and then what is the Prime Minister of England going to make of that president? Like, the idea is just absurd. I mean,
it gives the world another reason to just have no respect for us, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, right.
In a time where Obama, when he got elected, he went on this, I call it the contrition tour. He went around basically apologizing for the foreign policies of the administration that preceded him, and I felt like, man, and that's so refreshing for him to make these speeches. And of course, the conservative, you know, Fox News and everything said, oh my God, this is just proof that our country is getting weaker. We don't need a president apologizing for America. I think we do. And I think humility and a little bit of contrition for the way we've behaved in this imperialistic kind of way that America's behaved is good. We need more of that. You know, and we don't need someone to come out. We don't need a president like Trump who's a loudmouth, obnoxious, America's the greatest country on earth. That's the last thing that we need. This world needs to go in a place of more humility and more like germane thinking where it's about everyone as opposed. And that's a beautiful thing about the PC culture too. I mean, without, I don't want to shit on it too much. This is all inclusive idea of everyone is equal. Let's try to be nicer to each other and understand each other more, you know, and that is a nice place to be, but I don't know if that's necessarily the motivations of everyone who's so outraged. You know, I think it is about a solipsistic, this selfish idea of let me be heard and let me just voice my complaints because I'm not happy where I want to be. Let me get my two cents in. For some people on Twitter, it might be like an artistic expression. Instead of having to do anything like a real artist would have to do or write like a real writer would have to write a book or write a major article about something or fucking paint a bunch of pictures or make an album, I get to be the Twitter artist that gets to like bang out 140 character, you know, thoughts that say something, that contribute. I don't know. I feel like there's something to be said about the work ethic and actually working on something and putting a lot of thought behind something as opposed to the impulsive need to just say what's ever on your mind, you know, or to judge something that someone said. To say whatever's on your mind without thinking, that's pretty much how I.
If you could turn a switch, if you could flip a switch, and all social media was gone, would you flip that switch? I would.
No, I mean,
I would. Absolutely.
Well, that makes us look old. Like we're old people who are afraid of like the new social technology.
No, it is what it is, and I use it too. I think it's a lot of fun. However, I think in the long run, it's more damaging.
You mean social media or like the internet as a
whole? Social media.
Social media.
Social media.
I mean, I know.
Social media.
Here's what I got to say about that in terms of like Facebook and Twitter. Like the few fans that I do have that watch my work, I think I got through Facebook. You know what I mean?
I see people to go see my movies when
there was no advertising money to go see them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, me too. I mean,
so
me too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I understand. It's complex. Yeah. Sure. And I guess I'm talking about more on a more universal social level. I think it's just actually does more harm than good the way people overshare too quickly, as you said, respond in like a very bullying way. I don't know.
But the reverse of that is there's positive effects too. That, you know what I mean? Like we got Obama elected. Social media got it. You know what I mean?
I just miss the days of I guess maybe I am sounding like a bit of a fogey.
Yeah. What was I going to say regarding just that point you were talking about? I have a friend of mine named Virginia. No, this is basically plugging my friend's book. It's a book. Her name is Virginia Heffernan. But here's the thing. She's just written a book. She's a very intelligent, very, very amazing
I've seen her name up and also
– Yeah, but she's got a book coming out called Magic and Loss about the internet being this great, comprehensive, just art project.
Right.
You know, of course, and you can criticize the, hey, this generation, whatever it is, Generation 911 or whatever they're called. What is the new generation called? We're Generation X. What's this generation? Generation Y, Z, Generation Twitter or whatever the hell they call it. It's like they appropriate content as opposed to really creating it, which I don't know. There's just as opposed to having hundreds of thousands of artists, now we have millions of artists who think they're an artist when they put like a fucking mix mashup of all the Marvel action scenes on YouTube. Right, and at the end of the video, they say, bye. So-and-so, like they fucking made they edited all this shit together. Sure. They didn't create the content. That annoys the hell out of me. But Magic and Loss, from what I've heard, is like it's a celebration of like how this is making us more aware culture and a more – well, I don't know the specifics, but it's just a being a big art project. Okay. And I'm looking forward to her going into – seeing the positive sides of it. You know what I mean?
All right, well, maybe I should have her on then.
Well, it'd be good. I wish Marc Maron had more writers on. I wish he'd have writers on in general. We should celebrate book culture. You know what I mean?
I do.
Like, that would
I
be...
have authors on, but they usually wrote a book about something about like film. I just had David Itzkoff of the New York Times on.
Oh, with his book about like a reviewing.
No, he has a book on the movie Network, Sidney Lumet, Patty Chayefsky.
Oh, about the actual book. Oh, wow.
No,
you read the book and talked to him about it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, I've done that a bunch of times.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I had Owen Gleiberman
A.O.
with
Scott
book.
Just wrote a book about book.
No, it's about criticism in general.
Uh-huh.
It's more of a tract about criticism. It's not about film. And
okay.
It's more just about being a critic and the art of criticism.
Yeah.
You know, where it's at socially. And I did invite him on. He said he would come on. And, you know, we were old summer camp friends.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Is he about your age? You guys must
yes.
be. Oh, wow.
And he said we were texting or rather emailing. And he said he would come on. And he was going to do that TV thing that you and me and Block did, actually.
Oh, okay.
This is the
first
time Jamie Block's name came up in the podcast.
Oh, really?
The last time.
Well,
but anyway, we did that TV show. Remember? Uh-huh. I was going to A.O. Scott, Tony Scott. Was going to do it with me. He said he'd do it after the Oscars, and we had a bunch of emails and tweets back and forth about it. I got a copy of the book from his publisher, and then I didn't hear.
Did you read the book?
Yeah, no.
Okay, well, I'm really curious to read the book.
I'm reading it.
I'm sure a big complaint from critics is, okay, we've been reduced to – we've been lumped into this pool of all these, you know – teenagers and key people that don't know much about film at all, they're just writing these quickie reviews online. They get lumped in with like real critics. And it's like people go to Rotten Tomatoes and there's 250 reviews and so many of them are just so badly written and not thoughtful at all. And like, again, it goes to this commitment to your craft, commitment to what you're passionate about, writing a really thoughtful review. I remember –
that's why I stopped doing it.
Because
before I knew you, I was writing reviews, but not like for a living.
You
I was
stopped
just,
because of,
I was getting asked to write reviews by a few different websites, but I just thought I don't like writing reviews, and I don't even though I got better at writing them. You know, I felt like I wouldn't read these. Why would anybody else?
Well, I got to tell you, when Batman and Superman came out, I was really caught up in the fact that it's this collective cultural phenomenon that everybody was talking about in terms of the internet zeitgeist or whatnot, whatever the fuck is in the internet everywhere. So I listened to a lot of podcasts and I read a lot of reviews, and so many of them just said the same thing, and they were repeating the same base simplistic ideas of every other review. It almost felt like they were reading each other's reviews and saying, oh, I'm getting whatever, $50 or $100 to write this review. I don't have anything really to say about it.
If anything, right?
There's so much – probably – I didn't see the movie, but I'm assuming there's so much in that movie. And there were a lot of clever, really interesting, clever reviews online too, right? But like there's so much in that film that you could probably just single out and say, let me talk about this in a way that's interesting, the way no one else has done, you know, which is I think the role and responsibility of artists and of critics. If you're going to – criticism is an art. Any art form, writing, music, whatever, where you take it seriously and you're passionate. Building a fucking house. I mean, art is everywhere. Passion is art. Love, all that good stuff, you know, all the positive things. But the bottom line is like it's just, you read this and it's like this is people go to Rotten Tomatoes and they just see this like 25%. And a friend of mine named Angus wrote a cultural critique of this binary aspect of like going to review and going to Rotten Tomatoes and just seeing that it's at a low percentage and just judging the
writing
film based on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so it's just interesting, this whole idea of critique. I mean, like, and I do some reviews for the Talk Cow sometimes, but it's different for when you're a filmmaker.
Is that a review?
It's kind of a cultural kind of, you know, Nick Dawson, he wrote a book.
I know Nick.
He wrote a book on
William Friedkin.
Who directed fucking Harold and Maude?
Oh, Hal Ashby.
I think he wrote a book on
Hal
Ashby.
Did he write the Hal Ashby book? Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. He wrote the Hal Ashby book. William Friedkin wrote the one on William Friedkin.
Did he write a book?
Yeah, it was an autobiographical book. Nick did. I see Nick all the time because they go to the same screenings. I know he's the editor of the Talk House.
Yeah, which does
who
music.
Who publishes? Who underwrites that?
I don't know, but I hope it keeps going, which is because it's artists reviewing, musicians reviewing music, and filmmakers reviewing film.
I know
and,
it is.
And that's an interesting perspective because it's like if I had a movie come out and nobody really ever reviews my movies. But if they hate it or whatnot, and my movies are hated, I mean, that sucks. But it's like if filmmakers like my movie, it feels like it's almost – I feel like in a way it's sort of validated. You know what I mean? If I can get a filmmaker to like my film as opposed to – well, depending on the critic, you know. If it's a critic that's – I don't know. Every good review means something. And every bad review, if it's thoughtfully written – you know, I hate a writer that just dismisses everything about a movie that I've done. To me, that's just really unfair.
Yeah.
Everything about this movie sucks, and that's just not true. I've made movies, and there's amazing actors and amazing performances from actors. And when you say the whole thing sucks, it's like just leaving those people out. I say this all the time when I'm talking. So let's.
Well, I'm going to say if you Google the New York Times review
of Richard's Wedding, you're singled out in that, right? It's
just I got a good review in that. But I know, and you got a good review for Summer of Blood. I remember the New
I
York
tell
Times
you when I moving to from North Carolina to New York 5 years ago and making Richard's Wedding a year after I was here. And seeing that review in the New York Times for a guy who moved from North Carolina to New York to get that was such a highlight. It was such a huge,
Of, I don't know if vindication is the right word, but certainly.
I just felt like I was, oh man, this is the first film I made in New York, and to get reviewed in the New York Times, it gave me a lot of confidence. It buoyed my confidence.
And a good review.
Yeah, it was a good review. And like, to have the 1 week run that we had at the Rerun Theater at the time in Dumbo, that stuff meant so much to me, and like it still does. You know what I mean? It's just that I don't know. You know, we've been complaining the whole time. That's the culture we live in. There's a constant barrage of complaints.
Can you be complacent, or can you get to a point of being satisfied? You know?
Satisfied. I would like to be able to make a living at some point. You know what I mean? I'd like to be able to make a living to such a degree where I wouldn't have to.
We'll see. Maybe after Catfight, because this seems.
I don't know if that's true. Think about all the movies that come out that have a really good cast. You know, they get lost, and they, you know, maybe it won't make many money at all. Brilliant movies come out all the time that you never hear about. That's the thing that's exciting and depressing about film festivals. You go there, you see great movies that you never hear about again. And then you see mediocre movies that did so well.
And we're talking from a festival here in Montclair, New Jersey.
And going back to Justin Simien and Dear White People, I think there's probably a sense of resentment or bitterness towards a young filmmaker that gets such success early on. You know, I'm in my early 40s, and I don't feel very successful for the most part, feeling like it's a really base, superficial reaction to, you know, that movie is good, but does he deserve to get his career just to take off, catapult himself into a great career this early, like while everybody else has to work so hard?
You're talking about Justin?
The guy who did Dear White People.
Yeah, Justin Simien. Did that catapult him? What is he doing now? Did he get a TV deal?
At the time that it came out, it was just like everywhere. Like,
well,
people know who he is now.
New directors, new films, right? And then
New
York.
But, like, it premiered
and then
at Sundance. And it was – I would see him on talk shows. The Daily Show was everywhere. Like, culturally, it was – culturally, people knew about that film. And like, I'm not talking about money here. I don't know if he got rich. And I doubt he did get rich. I doubt he probably made very much money at all on the film. But I'm assuming now that if he wants to make a $2 or $3 million film – I don't know. My assumptions are bullshit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I'm
That's
sure.
That's not much easier. As a person of color, too, he's never going to have an easier time than white people to get
movies made. What was the name again of the director who made Fruitvale Station?
Oh, yeah. Then he
made Creed.
Creed, very overrated film to me. Like,
I don't
know. I'm a huge Rocky fan, and I thought that movie was a disgrace to the Rocky films based on the fact that it was really well directed in terms of, like, you know, choreography and like scenes and the way he moves the camera. Amazing. The fight, except for the last fight scene, there was CG in the last fight scene.
Was there? I don't remember.
It looked like a fucking video games at times. It was insulting to me. But what really insulted me about the film, and listen, I'm not going to, what, you're not supposed to do this because it's a black director? I fuck that. It's like, I'm a huge Rocky fan. And good, that's the Rocky movies were so successful, not based on the fights. The fights are exciting by the, you know, you want to see, you know, whatever's going to happen. But the characters, man, Mickey and Adrian and fucking Rocky himself and the fucking
and,
Mickey.
Mickey.
And
of
like, those characters. So, and fucking the Adrian Burt Young playing what's his name in the movie?
Come on!
It shows you how much I know about the fucking movies. I can't remember. Polly. Fucking Polly.
Polly.
All these characters are so rich throughout the whole series.
Like, cool.
They're so amazing and like, and they were full of life and it was witty and it was fucking funny. Adam Creed had it was not funny at all. Okay, it's about cancer and rock, whatever the fuck it's about.
Well, the Sylvester Stallone was funny.
And Creed, from the first movie, was a scintillating personality. He was ebullient, full of life, and cocky and arrogant.
You think they've lost that?
That movie had no personality at all. Creed, I'm not saying the Creed's son is supposed to be this kind of dark character with demons. You know, he's living in the shadow of his father he never even knew, and not knowing his place in the world, and like not sure. And I liked a lot of the themes. I like where it went with it. But ultimately, you can't. The critics, man, look at Rotten Tomatoes.
Everybody
it was
loved it.
Fucking lauded as this amazing.
Well,
it's the best movie of the year. People complain that it wasn't nominated for the best film of the year.
Well, the critics
That's
got
the shit
together.
That outrageous.
Which
me.
Is kind of like that the critics get together and they create a perception, whether it's true or not. And the only thing that bothered me about that movie was the timeline, because they decided to make this movie, but the kid is too young.
It
took place in 76. No, but it took place during 1976. Literally during, I mean, the first Rocky, during the bicentennial, right? That was.
Yeah, but no, that's not.
And then the second one.
He was born in 88, though, before Apollo dies in Rocky IV. That was the idea.
Apollo died in 4? Oh, wait, the Russian.
The Russian, Ivan
was
Drago.
It wasn't Mr.
Kills,
T. It was the Russian.
Rocky IV, Drago. Ivan Drago kills Apollo in the ring. And the idea is based on the fact that he inseminated his mistress.
Well, I understand. Impregnated.
inseminated. I don't even know. I can't
remember. Inseminated.
You ever see Ping Pong Summer, Michael Tully's
Pong
Summer?
Yes, of course I saw.
That's one of the great lines of an independent film when the villain says, inseminate him. It's just brilliant. So I think I just like that. I always will try to quote that. But. Apollo dies in 1988, 87, whenever, and the idea is that he impregnated his mistress in 88, which would make the almost 29 years
so
old.
So was there?
You're
saying the timeline works?
Yeah, it totally works. Totally got.
Because I thought I read even that was right. That I thought that
no,
we'll have to go to
that
back
would
and
bother
check
me too
out.
A little bit, but that would bother me way less if the character I could the kid could have been born in 1960 and looked like he's 16 if the characters are interesting and like the movie pops. And I just felt like the movie was so. Just innervated and like it had no life. And the Rocky movies were about life. This movie's about Rocky actually regaining the will to live.
Jason Schwartzman's brother, Robert Schwartzman, made this movie. It was at Tribeca. It was the worst movie I've seen. It's I won't mention it by name.
Well,
let me just say, because I don't want to.
People should say things like that. I tell people that if somebody hates my film, I love it when they tell me.
Jason was in it, and he, you know, he was on the podcast. You were with him on the podcast. I don't want to alienate these people, but the problem I had it was a flawed film. Let's put it that way. But it's his first effort as a director, and he acted in it. Maybe he shouldn't have. But they shot the scenes with Talia Shire. And she looked just so awful in the movie, and I was thinking, you shouldn't show your mother like that.
Well, I don't
you
know.
Should shoot her, figure out how to
I
make
don't
dollar
think that's
up.
A, I think
put
that's
some Vaseline on the lens, something.
I'm not offended at all, but I feel like that's somewhat like an offensive comment, because who cares how someone looks on a camera?
I do.
You know what I mean?
I'm old-fashioned. I want my Talia Shire, who was never a beauty, even in Rocky.
She's one of the beauties.
But she was playing Jane with those.
She's beautiful
those,
in that
What
movie.
Do they call those librarian glasses?
Yeah.
But she, those cat kind of. She was so. Yeah, she was very simple looking.
You don't put that in there about how she looks.
What do you mean? They just didn't shoot her looking.
But here's your point. The point is, I don't have a problem with people loving great movies. That's great. But if a movie is not that great, just somebody, just let's have more negative reviews. Let's just this kind of cultural consensus of this is so terrific without really, you know.
Well, there's the whole philosophy: don't review a bad movie, just let it.
Is that kind of the philosophy behind?
Oh yeah,
it?
I mean, yeah. I've
maybe that's why my
it
films
was maybe Hammer to Nail did that too.
Yeah.
Their philosophy was if it's good. Review it. If you didn't like it, we won't review
it.
Well,
I think that as a filmmaker, if you're reviewing something, it's tough to criticize a movie as a filmmaker. You feel
right.
Very hypocritical.
And you're going
to
run into them.
And
know.
There's no accounting for taste, and there's all... Oh, fuck, I just used that cliche. And there's also... It's so subjective.
You don't like cliches at all.
Well, I just... You can't be helped. And, like, my whole life is based on an amalgam. It's extrapolation of everything you've heard and talked about. You know, you've heard
but
the people say.
So on another level, though... As we wind down, because you know, but don't you think that maybe the problem also, and I was thinking this today as I was sitting on the couch and I'm looking at jurors who are reviewers, who are filmmakers, who are programmers, who are, you know, and I'm thinking, and I myself am guilty of this, but they're hanging out with like review, you know, like journalists are hanging out with programmers who are hanging out with the actors and directors.
Sure.
And I think it's, you know, it's inevitable, but there's so many festivals now that, you know, that you see people all the time, and now they're your social life because you go from popping from one film event to another festival, to this and that. And what happens when you write that bad review or if you don't program that film in your festival and all of a sudden that director who you see all the time and you're buddies with, they're going to, you know, there used to be a lot of separation of church and state, and now there isn't. And I wonder if that isn't part of what you're referring to. About
course,
people not
of
writing
course
bad
it is.
Reviews
of course.
About, but don't we do a disservice if we're not going to write the bad review and we're going to, you know,
hang out with your friends, drink with the filmmakers, do whatever you want.
Right.
When it comes to the art, look at the art as objectively as you can.
Can you,
you
do
know
that?
What I mean?
You
well,
don't have
I,
a,
I know
can
one
you,
thing.
If somebody, if like somebody like Aaron gives you a bad review,
I'd be totally
something.
Fine with that and cool with that. And
okay.
I wish that my friends would do that, and also too. But I also think that my films play funnier to people who know me personally. You know what I mean? Like if you kind of understand how kind of, you know, whatever, down to earth and what my sense of humor is, I think the film plays a little bit better if you know, you know the person. That might have something to do with it as well, you know? But no, I feel like art, and there should be harsh criticism, and like when people go to art openings, they should look at the art and openly talk shit about it. Now, I've heard stories about the Cannes Film Festival and how people will slam the doors violently as they're leaving the theater during the movie
and boo.
As it's happening. And boo. I'm not for that because that's a distraction. That's impeding other people from watching the film objectively. You know what
right.
I mean? That's why
right.
I'm against any kind of distraction in a movie theater. It should be a sacred fucking place, like a fucking church when you watch a film. I just can't stomach it, man. That's one of the reasons I have a hard time going to the theater now. I get so distracted and so angry. I feel like...
Like
so angry when somebody pulls out a cell phone that I just can't. It ruins my experience where I can't even focus on what's on the screen.
I get the same way.
But when you're out of the theater and you're writing it, it's all put the gloves on, man, or the gloves off, whatever that cliche is,
and
rip the movie apart, and that's great. And like
you know, it's when the gloves come off.
But I also think sometimes, like with Batman and Superman, it got really excessive where people were just trying to be funny and clever, ripping the movie apart in a way that wasn't necessarily fair to maybe what the filmmakers were trying to do. But you know, it's whatever.
When we came out of that movie, my expectations because of mostly the critics or the what is called the you know that were the early articles and the early reviews were saying it was so bad in so many ways, you know, and so my expectations were, you know, that it was just exactly
yeah.
My son, who, you know, I took to it, his expectations were really high, right? He loves superheroes,
yeah.
You know. So we go to the movie and we're watching, and we come out at the end, and you know, because my expectations were so low, I was there. There was only things to like because, you know, it was only going to be like, you know, be surprised by certain things. So I walked out and I thought, all right, well, I expected worse.
Yeah,
and
right.
And Jacob was like, I was kind of disappointed.
Yeah, sure.
And I was like, I thought it was very funny. And I, you know, the main reason for he had is because it's the Superman and Batman don't behave this way. You know, it just wasn't. He wants his superheroes like, you know, he loves Adam West. Like, you know, he doesn't want Batman like at that level, like people.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, well, that's complaints bullshit. Superheroes, a dark superhero kill. Fucking the Avengers kill people all the time. You just don't see the, you know, victims. And that's just what the fuck happens. That's what I love about Civil War, by the way, is it kind of addresses that idea.
But Jacob at 11, 12, you know, they love Spider-Man and Captain America. These guys don't do that.
Right.
You know?
But they don't. I haven't seen Batman and Robin, Catman versus Superman, Batman versus Superman.
Oh, you haven't? Okay.
I haven't seen it. But one of the complaints, when I would hear people, that movie was so, of course, ripped apart, just like completely. When I would hear positive reviews on podcasts or whatnot, which were very entertaining at times, the people that tried to say they liked it struggled. Like, you could just tell they were just trying to find some reason to like
something
it. But you going back to the same, you having a problem with the Rocky timeline, which you're wrong about, but I could understand you having a problem with that, that wrecking the whole movie, the foundation of the movie, that the foundation of Batman and Superman was flawed because majority of the people didn't buy the motivation behind the two fighting each other. And that's a big part of it. You know, you have to believe there's a real intent or motivation behind wanting to beat each other up. These two supposedly superheroes and with benevolent, you know, intentions.
Yeah.
If you're going to have these two fighting, it's got to be a legitimate reason. And one of the cool things about Civil War is there's a real justification in why these characters are going after each other. And it all comes down to the themes of loss and collateral damage and the personal. When you want vengeance based on losing a family member or protecting a friend, you can't reason with that. You know what I mean? Logic doesn't dictate your heart if it's been broken. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing. Okay. And there's a lot of implications that go with our foreign policy and wars that we dictate and drone strikes or whatever. You know, the ethical kind of ramification, the ethical reasons why we do them as opposed to getting our people on the front lines, but then the damage that's done, you know, culturally in the areas that we bomb. This is going on way too long. Yeah, but anyway, it's, you know.
Well, I'm supposed to take him to see it. He's dying to see it.
Oh, I fucking loved it. No, I'm doing a review for Talkhouse on that.
Oh, you
I'm
are? Who are you interviewing?
It's a review. It's a movie
it's a review. Okay.
So it's a 10-page comic review, and I have to admit, I went into that film wanting to hate it because of all the, you know, by the time I saw it, it was like, I didn't read any reviews, but there was like a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, and again, I was pissed off, like, oh, again, another cultural consensus of how great it is, like the opposite of Batman and Superman. So I went in wanting to hate it, and it fucking, I adored it. I fucking adored
it. Well, I'm going to take Jacob to see. He wants to see it tomorrow.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really cool. Yeah.
Last thing. I did try to reach you recently. You didn't return my calls.
No, I did. It was an email. We saw Damsels in Distress together, and you were so sweet to give me an invitation to see Wisdom's new movie, you know, Love and Friendship.
There's that. But I also tried to call you or text you because I have the studio, but I still need to, and I want to pay a few people for all the work they've done for me and retroactively and also pay a publicist, and I want to get new equipment for the podcast. And maybe put a little money into so I'm going to do my first fundraiser. So I was so I need to shoot something. So I was thinking maybe you would shoot it with me, like, but to come up with something like that.
Oh, I'll help you with any way that I can, Adam. Of course, you know,
because it would be
good. I have a 5D that you guys loan my 5D out to everybody who wants to use it. I don't know if I should be the person behind the camera shooting it, but there's plenty of people who can shoot it and would do that. Would come out for a good cause, which is talking about culture and books now too, which is great because we just need to.
No, but I need to shoot the video. Yeah, it's true, but no, I'm saying is I need to shoot like a fundraiser video, like a video to promote the Kickstarter, because I have to figure out what's going to be funny, and then I have to also get people to shoot like testimonials and stuff like that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
All right,
great seeing you and talking to you, man. I love you, and it is good seeing you again.
Same here.
Yeah, man. All right.
That's the show, folks. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. That's it, folks. That's the episode. We'll be back. I think we should have, by the next show, recorded the podcast with D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus, and they're about their documentary, Unlocking the Cage. We had this live podcast event, and I'm thinking it should be ready by the next episode, so hopefully that'll be the case. And then we're going to have a show with the filmmaking team behind the classic documentary Heavy Metal Parking Lot. Jeff Krulik and John Hine will be on that show. I met up with them at South by Southwest a couple of months ago, and there is going to be this big photo exhibit about that film. It's in, I believe, in Baltimore, but we're timing it with the opening of that gallery show. So if you should be going through that area, but I'll get into more into the details in a couple of weeks when we play that episode. Okay, folks, thank you very much. Please subscribe if you haven't subscribed. Please don't hesitate. If you are a subscriber, either way, please do go to our iTunes and give us a star rating and leave a nice comment. It really does help the show very much. And, you know, I mention it all the time because of that reason. It doesn't seem to be sinking in, but nevertheless, I appreciate your listening to the show. This is another episode of the podcast. We're part now of the Showbriz Studio Podcast Network under the tutelage of Alex Brazell, and I'm very excited about that. And we'll be actually recording a couple of episodes coming up from the studio in the coming weeks. All right, folks, so that's it. I'm going to sign off here. You've been listening to FilmWax Radio, episode number 351. Until next time, take care.
Trying to be fair, and you're trying to be there, and to care, and you're caught up in your permanent emotions, and all the loving I've been giving goes unnoticed, it's just floating in the air. Looky there, are you aware? You're my lifeline and you're trying to kill me. If it wasn't me, would you still feel me? Like on my worst day, or am I not thirsty enough? I don't care about the lights or the beams. Spend my life in the dark, but it's like you and me. Only way to go is up.